The EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network presents Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis. Each week, Joan Lewis brings you news from inside the Vatican and the Church around the world, as well as interviews and answers to your questions. Now, here's EWTN Rome Bureau Chief, Joan Lewis.
Welcome to Vatican Insider at this midway point in July. Before I get to a few news headlines, I urge you to stay tuned after the news for my conversation with Monsignor Richard Sossman of the Diocese of Peoria in Illinois. He's the Vice Postulator for the Cause for Canonization of Venerable Servant of God Archbishop Fulton Sheen. You won't want to miss this. Now, almost obscuring the little news there was this week in the Vatican was the big story of the deepening of a 36-year-old mystery, the disappearance on June 22, 1983, of Emanuela Orlandi, the 15-year-old daughter of a Vatican employee and citizen. She never came home that day after a music lesson, and the family, as well as Vatican City and Italian officials, have been trying since then to learn of her fate. Was she kidnapped, sold into slavery, killed? What happened to her? Last summer, 2018, the Orlandi family lawyer received an anonymous note suggesting to them that her remains were in the Teutonic Cemetery in Vatican City and that they should, quote, seek where the angel indicates. The note included the words, Requiescat in pace, rest in peace. Well, two tombs, both of German princesses who died in the 19th century, fit that description, and after informing descendants of the princesses, convening lawyers, members of the Orlandi family, and Vatican officials, including the head of the gendarmerie, those tombs were opened on July 11th. Not only were the remains of Emanuela not present, there were no bones whatsoever, no funerary urns, nothing of the two princesses. Stunning news. To leave no stone unturned, the Vatican had decided to also check in on and around the Teutonic College, which is adjacent to the cemetery where construction work had taken place at the end of the 19th century and also in the 1960s and 70s. And, in even more stunning news, it was announced by the press office on July 12th that, in fact, two ossuaries placed under the pavement of an area inside the Pontifical Teutonic College, enclosed by a trap door, had been discovered. They were immediately sealed and will be examined by competent Vatican authorities. So now we have to wait for forensic analysis and for the mystery to be either solved or further deepened. Those are expected to be opened on July 20th. Now, there's very little papal news as the Holy Father is still on a quiet, so-called working vacation in the Vatican, although he does appear at his study window in the Apostolic Palace on Sundays to recite the Noon Angelus with the faithful gathered in St. Peter's Square. In fact, Sunday, July 14th, Pope Francis, addressing the crowds gathered in the square, appealed to Venezuelan political leaders to reach an agreement for the good of the suffering nation and entire region. Once again, said Francis, I would like to express my closeness to the beloved people of Venezuela, who have been particularly hard hit by the continuing crisis. He asked the Lord to inspire and enlighten the parties involved so that they can reach an agreement as soon as possible that will put an end to the suffering of the people for the good of the country and the entire region. Now, the Venezuelan bishops had asked Thursday that President Nicolas Maduro resign from the office which he, quote-unquote, illegitimately exercises and that a new president be elected in the shortest time possible. In their July 11th apostolic exhortation, released at the end of their General Assembly, the bishop said, quote, in face of the reality of an illegitimate and failed government, Venezuela is crying out for a change of direction, a return to the Constitution. That change demands the departure of the one exercising power illegitimately and the election in the shortest possible time of a new president of the republic. Under Maduro's socialist administration, Venezuela has been marred by violence and social upheaval, with severe shortages of food and medicine, high unemployment, and hyperinflation. More than 4 million Venezuelans have emigrated since 2015. The bishops also cited a July 4 report from the United Nations Human Rights Commissioner that said the government has committed a variety of human rights abuses, including a high number of extrajudicial killings. Now back to papal news. On Monday, July 15th, Pope Francis joined the celebrants at a funeral mass for Cardinal Paolo Sardi and presided over the rite of the final commendation and farewell. Sardi had died 2 days earlier at the age of 84. The College of Cardinals now has 219 members, 110 of whom are under the age of 80, and therefore cardinal electors. Thursday, July 18th, that very date, July 18, was the focus of a letter the Pope sent to a Jewish center in Argentina to commemorate the 25th anniversary of a terrorist bombing that left 85 people dead and hundreds wounded, precisely on July 18th, 1994. 25 years have passed since the AMIA tragedy, wrote the Pope, noting that every single 18th of July, I keep in my heart the families of the victims, both Jews and Christians. He'd written to the Jewish Center in Buenos Aires, whose headquarters were destroyed by a terror attack, as we said, on the 18th of July, that killed 85 people and wounded over 200 others. Francis decried, quote, the madness of destroying lives and hopes in the name of religion and the blasphemous use of the name of God. We know well, he wrote, that it's not religion that incites and leads to war, but the darkness in the hearts of those who commit irrational acts. Francis then assured the families of the victims that he prays to God for the eternal rest of those who lost their lives in this act of madness, and he said, I also pray for those who survived the explosion that wounded them in their bodies and in their souls. And then, referring to the, quote, Third World War being fought piecemeal, the Pope said this madness is certainly not limited to Argentina, but, quote, it tramples on lives and on the future everywhere. It knows no boundaries and shows its cruel face from east to west. It transforms brides into widows, sons and daughters into orphans, and all this in the name of religion, making blasphemous use of God's name. Also on Thursday, July 18th, Pope Francis made important appointments in the Vatican media, naming Matteo Bruni as director of the Holy See Press Office. He also appointed Alessandro Gisotti, interim director for the past 6+ months, and Sergio Centofanti as deputy directors of the editorial directorate at the Dicastery for Communications. British-born Matteo Bruni, a layman, becomes the new spokesman of the Holy See on July 22nd. He graduated in modern and contemporary foreign languages and literature from Rome's La Sapienza University. He's been working since July 2009 at the Holy See Press Office, where he has been overseeing the accreditation of journalists and operational communications as coordinator of the accreditation section. In this role, he has organized reporters accompanying the Holy Father on papal trips outside Italy. Bruni speaks Italian, English, Spanish, and French. Alessandro Gisotti, interim director until July 22nd, is a graduate of political science from Rome's La Sapienza University and a professional journalist. After a stint at the United Nations Office of Information in Rome, he began working at Vatican Radio in the year 2000. From 2011 to 2016, he was deputy editor-in-chief at the Pope's radio. In 2017, he became the coordinator of the social media of the Vatican Dicastery for Communications. Alessandro has taught journalism at the Jesuit Maximus Institute in Rome and theories and techniques of journalism at the Pontifical Lateran University. Sergio Centofanti, born in Naples, graduated in literature from Rome's La Sapienza University in 1986. Starting his career as a journalist in the early 1980s, he joined Vatican Radio in 1986, working for the first 10 years with the morning edition World News in Italian. He has covered Popes John Paul II, Benedict XVI, and Francis on various Italian and international trips. In 2017, he was called to be part of the Multimedia Editorial Center in charge of coordinating the activities of the various language units of Vatican Radio / Vatican News. Well, those are the main news stories, but don't move. Stay here for my interview with Monsignor Richard Sulzman, Vice Postulator of the Cause for Canonization of Venerable Servant of God, Archbishop Fulton Sheen. And have a great weekend. Well, hi, and welcome to the Q&A portion of this week's show. I get never-ending emails and questions from visitors in Rome who ask how they can get tickets to a papal audience, how they can visit the Vatican museums, the best way to get into St. Peter's Basilica, etc. I can never answer these often enough, so today I'll just tell you that tickets to all papal audiences and liturgies are totally free of charge, and I do recommend contacting two places to get tickets. The first is the Church of St. Patrick, the Church for American and English-speaking Catholics in Rome. It has a terrific website with a lot of good travel information. So go to www.stpatricksamericanrome.com, all lowercase, stpatricksamericanrome.com. They provide tickets for Wednesday general audiences only, no papal liturgies. Once you've requested tickets, you can pick them up Tuesday before the Wednesday audience between 5 and 6:30 p.m. at the church on Via Boncompagni. The second office for getting tickets is called the Prefecture of the Papal Household. Go to www.vatican.va and look for Prefecture of the Papal Household. Everything you'll need to know is there. Another wonderful tip, if you allow me, my blog, Joan's Rome, has a link on the right side of the home page that says click here for practical information on visiting the Vatican, such as how to avoid the long waiting lines for the Vatican museums. Well, naturally, you go to the official website and reserve in advance. That and many other tips. Now go forth and have a great trip.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I want you to have such confidence in the Lord that you'll find such hope and see the beauty of the Lord, the majesty of God. What did our Lord say, huh? If your sins are as scarlet, oh, what? What's going to happen? They shall be made white as snow.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Hello, Journey Home family. Next time, we'll welcome Dr. Joshua Hochschild to the program. Dr. Hochschild will share how he went from atheism to Episcopalianism and then embraced the Catholic faith. Share the journey next time on EWTN's The Journey Home.
The Journey Home with Marcus Grodi is seen and heard around the world on EWTN. Join us Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio and Television.
This is a Messy Family Minute from Mike and Alicia Hernan. As moms and dads, we have a natural and grace-filled desire to lay down our lives for our children, to provide for their emotional and physical needs as best we can. Moms particularly can tend to burn ourselves out for the children, right, ladies? Lunching on leftover mac and cheese, getting up five times a night, cleaning endlessly. How should parents live an ordered life?
The first thing we need to remember is that there is no sacrament of parenthood. You receive the grace to be a parent through the sacrament of matrimony, through your marriage. This is how you will bring grace into your family, through celebrating your marriage. Putting your marriage first is the way to be a great parent.
Dads, sometimes you need to step in and remind your wife that she's first and foremost your beloved bride. It was God's order that you were first married, and from your love came the children. Remember, your marriage is the foundation of your family.
For encouragement and tools to strengthen your marriage and family life, visit us at messyfamilyminute.org.
Welcome back to Vatican Insider. Here's Joan Lewis.
Well, I have a special welcome today for my guest on the Vatican Insider interview segment, and that's Monsignor Richard Sussman. We've been friends for a number of years, because when you first came to Rome to study, then you later worked here. I'm going to ask you about that. But he is from the Diocese of Peoria in Illinois. I'm from Illinois myself, not far away. Peoria, as I think you all heard recently, this is the home diocese of Venerable Servant of God Fulton Sheen. And that's the person who's going to be the focus of our conversation today. So, Father Richard, welcome.
Thank you so much, Joan. It's nice to be here.
Well, let's talk about your priestly life for just a moment. You are a pastor in the Diocese of Peoria, but you were here on two different occasions, one to study and second to work at the Congregation for Clergy.
Right. After a year of ordination, Bishop Myers sent me to study canon law at the Lateran, so I was here for a couple of years then.
Good.
And then I came back in 2008 in January to work at the Congregation for Clergy, right. And I was there almost 10 years.
Almost 10. Wow, I hadn't even realized that. Well, you're in a rather sizable group of people. I've been here 40 years. You're in a sizable group of people I know who have come to study, come to work, and have gone back to being pastors, which is
right.
why you were in the seminary in the first place. Obviously, the focus of our conversation today is Bishop Sheen, Archbishop Sheen. So when did he first enter into your life? You're a young man, you'd heard about him, you'd seen him on TV. How?
Well, I'd certainly heard about him and listened to his tapes and when I was a small child, of course, he would come to the Diocese of Peoria often, and then it would always be in the Diocesan newspaper. And my mom would point out to me, you know, oh, Fulton Sheen's back in the diocese. And then I read several of his works and also gave some of his works in Spanish to a couple of Spanish priests who wanted them when I was a young priest. And then when Bishop Jenke came in 2002 to be our new bishop, he decided to undertake the cause. He asked me for three names of priests I thought could do a cause. I was judicial vicar at the time. And so 2 weeks later, I gave him three names. And he said, well, why don't you think about a little more? Give me, you know, a couple more names. So 2 weeks later, I gave him a couple more names. And he said, no, I want you to do it. So that's when I undertook to be the diocesan judge of the cause, to gather everything you have to gather at the local level. 67 books, the copies. I think there were 6,700 pages of Acts, both testimony from people who knew him, about over 100 witnesses, and then searches of the archives, so archival material, including the FBI file.
Wow. So archival in the sense also of television, I'm guessing,
yeah.
Right? Not only the written, but television. First of all, a cause only opens at the earliest 5 years after a person's death, unless a pope would change his mind. Is that correct?
Yes. It has to be usually after 5 years, unless there's a dispensation. If it's over 25 or 30 years, I can't remember, then you need to explain why it took so long. So the Vatican gives a kind of a window there. And we were just right at the time where we didn't have to explain. So we were just getting going just at the right time.
So now, who reads the documents? I mean, I was thinking when John Paul died, I knew they had to review everything he'd ever written and said, and it was like, oh my gosh, a mountain of material.
Right.
But there has to be a lot for Sheen because he was such a public figure.
Right. Well, at the local level, we had the Committee of Theologians and then Historical Commission, and so the theologians read his books when we found articles he'd written. They, you know, of course, had listened to some of his tapes or videos. But then they had to, in order to help the cause along, they gave a summary of each of the books, each of the historical commission members, and then their opinion on whether or not it was sound theology. And, of course, it always was. But it was a big task for them.
Because you could still come across one little thing that, oh, my gosh, how did we overlook this years ago?
Right.
This is questionable. In his case, I can certainly imagine that. I have to say, I grew up with him in the sense of watching him on TV as a youngster. I think it was when we got our first TV. And here on public television, this wouldn't happen today, was this amazing Bishop Fulton Sheen. And my parents made us watch it, but you know, I really don't like that word, made us, because we were riveted.
I understand.
It was amazing.
Yes. You know, when I called my mother to tell her the bishop had asked me to do this, she said, oh. And I said, well, what's wrong, Mom? She said, well, we watched him on TV, and we always thought of him as a holy priest, but I never thought of him as a saint. And that was kind of my thinking until I, within a few weeks of starting to do the investigation and hearing from people that had heard us once on EWTN. We had 275 letters in the P.O. box after 1 week.
Wow.
And they all, they were from people who knew him or met him when he was alive. And all the miraculous, wonderful, happy things they wrote about really was overpowering. And so I was quickly convinced that he would be a saint. But you're right, he reached many people on television, many people who maybe didn't even know he was a Catholic bishop. Somebody wrote in, we were Catholic in Portland, in Oregon, she said, and we watched him every week, but we didn't know he was a Catholic bishop. When we found that out, we were overjoyed because we were Catholic. So
wonderful.
When he went on television, he knew his audience had to be a little bit more general. And so he, of course, did address matters of philosophy, theology, sometimes politics, etc., but always from something that common people can understand no matter what faith.
Right. And then his radio show, are there radio archives?
Yes, there are some. He was the first preacher on radio anywhere, on any form, and so he preached on the Catholic Hour. National Council of Catholic Men had the Catholic Hour that was on every, I think, Sunday afternoon. So he would take the train to New York and then preach on the Catholic Hour and then go back to Washington, where he was teaching at Catholic University at the time. And that was over 20 years that he preached each week on the Catholic Hour. So a lot of those tapes do survive, but some don't.
I read the other day that when he had his Life is Worth Living, that 30 million people would tune in
to that.
Yes, that's true. He was asked to do a fill-in on the Dumont Network, which disappeared, of course, soon afterwards, but for 2 weeks in the summer, because they had a hole in their programming. And so he did, and it was so popular that they had him, and then it went eventually to, I think it was on ABC, The Life is Worth Living.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, but of course, at the time, the networks didn't all have national coverage, so they would pick up each other's shows sometimes, too. And $30 million was the right number, and that was when television didn't exist everywhere.
Right.
And they say that a third of his audience was Catholic, a third Protestant, a third Jewish. And
interesting.
In the second year, he was given the Emmy for the most outstanding television personality. Now, the number one show on television was his show.
Awesome.
The number two show was the first half hour of Milton Berle's show, which was on opposite his.
Oh, my God.
Milton Berle was an hour show, though, and the second half hour of his show was number one in that time slot. So Milton Berle would complain, you know, kind of jokingly.
Sure.
And I don't know how he gets away with this, you know. And he said, well, I have better writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
I love it. Oh, my God. He did have a wonderful sense of humor, and that always helps.
Yes.
I don't care what you do in life, a sense of humor. I want to ask a question a minute about the historical commission. Does every case that is open, every cause that's open for sainthood, is there a historical commission in the diocese?
Yes, there's always that at the local level. There are some exceptions for martyrs, which I would need to bone up on that if we're going to talk about it, but some exceptions for martyrs. But for a normal cause for saints, there is the local level, the diocesan cause.
Okay.
And then all that's assembled and then given the permission of the bishop, it's sealed and sent to the Congregation for Saints. And so,
do they send you information when a cause starts and a diocese doesn't really know, you know, steps 1 through 5? Does the bishop get information from the congregation? Here's what the minimum we need in this time period.
You know, the congregation's always very helpful when you approach them, but a lot of bishops don't even know to do that.
Oh.
I used to get a lot of phone calls from different people with possible, more lay people who knew of possible candidates for sainthood, and I would try to help them along the way. We quickly plugged into a Roman postulator, so we started getting the advice of a Roman postulator who helped to guide us through the steps. I studied the documentation myself, and you can do that, but he was very helpful, and he can be helpful to have someone to guide you along.
Well, the reason I ask is that Hawaii has become my second home. Practically, it's where I go for part of my vacation every year. And I started in 2008 when I went to cover Father, Blessed then, Damien.
Oh, sure.
Who had worked on Molokai with the victims of leprosy.
A good, fine Belgian.
And yes, there you go,
and
exactly.
One quarter Belgian.
I just became enamored of his story. And then obviously I got to know Mother Marianne, now St.
Yes.
Marianne.
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard of a third gentleman whose story I have followed for the last 11 years. And he was a lay person, but Damien said, you're like a brother to everyone, so he called him Brother Joseph Dutton.
Mm.
And the diocese has opened all the procedures for his cause, and I'm on the commission.
Oh, wonderful.
And the interesting thing, Father Richard, is that one of the things that I was asked to look into, I have different little side tasks on this guild. I was asked to find out if was a third order Franciscan. That would help the cause immensely. Speak to his prayer. Well, I found out he was.
Okay.
All the proof is in Syracuse, New York, and it was Mother Marianne who asked him to be and then enrolled him in the order.
Wonderful.
And I found out just by, you know, a serendipitous encounter here in Rome. So that's why I also asked the question about the historic, historical commission. So a cause is opened, and a bishop decides this and then just appoints people and, okay, you should be on the commission. How does that work to put these people together?
Well, the Episcopal delegate, or myself, I was in charge of then helping line things up for the bishop. For the theological commissioners, we chose those who had at least a license in theology, church license in theology, and I think actually one of them had a doctorate. So you find qualified people.
Right.
The historic commission, we had people in Peoria, but then we cooperated with the archives in Rochester and other places.
Right.
And some of us actually went to Rochester to do some deeper investigation and to get copies of things. But Bishop Sheen had a column in the Catholic newspaper syndicate every week, and he also had a secular column in
a newspaper.
Yeah, in the secular newspapers weekly. And so that's 52 a week for how many years?
Wow.
So there were a lot of things that we, as soon as I saw something, we printed it out, we tried to preserve it, but and a lot of the tapes, of course, and were lost.
Sure.
And so we presented the best we could to the congregation.
The best of the best. Well, it's wonderful, because the one advantage you certainly have with Sheen is that there are people, are still and were people who knew him.
Yes.
And could talk to him and be witnesses and oh, yes,
that
I used to pray.
Moving, yes.
Yeah, all the personal things or the encounters or his prayer life or whatever, which, for example, we don't have living witnesses, obviously, for, you know, for Brother Dutton. He died in 1931. So.
And that's why the congregation asked that you get a dispensation if it's been over, I think, 30 years.
Oh, sure.
But they give it freely, especially, but it's always best to have eyewitnesses, you know, some people who actually knew. And they were fascinating. A lot of his relatives, people who studied under him, people who worked with him. Just fascinating.
I think I read recently, when the news came out about his cause, wasn't it Pope Emeritus Benedict who was absolutely enthralled by the way he taught, by Sheen's charism?
Yes, because Pope Emeritus Benedict was an expert for the Commission on Missions for the Second Vatican Council, and Sheen was a member.
Oh.
Yeah, so...
I did not know that.
Yes, and so there are pictures, you know, of that commission where they had met up in the mountains, you know, and done some of their preliminary work, and Pope Benedict's just behind Fulton Sheen.
Wow.
And it said also, I've heard this more than once from solid, you know, citizens, that Pope John Paul used to perfect his English by listening to Fulton Sheen.
Oh, my word! No surprise at all, because, yes, he would have been on television in those years, obviously.
Yeah, no.
He started Life is Worth Living, I think, in 1951, right, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's all the time today that Monsignor Sosman and I have for our conversation about the cause for sainthood of Venerable Servant of God, Archbishop Fulton Sheen. But come back next week at this time for part two, when you'll learn, among other things, the specific duties of a vice postulator for a cause and the status of Archbishop Sheen's cause for canonization.